Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to The Sound of London. This is Londonist Out Loud. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and this week we're going to a place that I've been looking forward to getting inside for quite some time. It's London's Museum of Comedy. A lot of Twitter activity going on in the last weeks in response to our pub crawl. Thanks again to Vic Norman for that. And thanks to Ravi for a particular comment, which kind of knocked my hat off with its kindness. If you want to get in touch with show ideas, show requests, or general goodwill, it's at Londonist Sound. And so to this week's episode, a few minutes walk from Holborn Tube Station to a museum that runs no risk of taking itself too seriously.
Hey baby, let me take you down, so we'll play some strange sights and sounds you ain't never seen the light before, just a stone through from your front door.
Listen to this. Isn't that a beautiful sound? After 4 weeks, I think at least, of contending with traffic ambience in the background as we've made our way around London, I am at last recording the show in a place that's designed, well, not designed originally for sound, but has certainly been adapted to make full use of its excellent acoustics. We're underground. And we're in Bloomsbury, and the place I'm in is a museum dedicated to comedy. We are in the theatre area of it, the performance area, with excellent acoustics and an excellent guest who is the assistant curator. He's David Hardcastle. Hi.
Hi.
And you're one of many David. I could have had a pick of Davids today.
Yeah, we've got several actual Davids who work here, and the entire technical department who like to call each other Dave.
for what reason?
I've no idea. They're techies. It's another world.
Perhaps a good place to start would be to explain where we are, because it's not where you would necessarily expect to find a comedy venue.
No, possibly not. We're in technically the undercroft of St. George's Church in Bloomsbury, which is a beautiful Grade 1 listed Hawksmoor church.
And we're going to be looking up the steeple later on. We had a debate earlier on what was up the steeple.
Yeah.
Is it King George? Is it a unicorn? Is it none of the above?
I think the unicorn's definitely still up there. And we've got a little plaster cast of the unicorn on the in the entrance as you come in. So I think that's still up there. I've no idea about King George.
I'm not sure about the monarch.
No. Nor do I care.
Well, that's not an auspicious start, is it?
Apathy rules, I think that's the way.
Good. 40 minutes of apathy coming up, listener. The place we're in, a quick description. Well, it looks like the archetype of a underground, literally underground comedy venue. The silver bar stool sits alone on a black stage. There's the microphone on a stand and a red velvet curtain. The ceiling is vaulted. The lights are low. There are pictures by, I believe, a photographer of some repute of various comedy stars.
Trevor Rogers, I believe. Yeah, it's a collection of pictures of alternative comedians from the 70s. So you've got Rick Mail, Alexis Sale, French and Saunders, I believe, Neil from the Young Ones, a whole collection of comedians from that era who were appearing at the Comedy Store Players, I think.
You come from a fine arts background. Now, I'm not sure whether to say that comedy is or isn't part of that, a natural offshoot or part of it, or...
Well, my route into this was, obviously, like all people who studied fine art at college, I went into graphic design and originally started designing stuff for the theatre for Leicester, well, originally for the Arts Theatre and Leicester Square Theatre, which are both owned by Martin Witt, who owns the Museum of Comedy. But I was also dabbling in comedy part-time and running things. And I started running... We run a new comedian competition at Leicester Square Theatre. And I started running that and I'm gradually sort of eased my way in. So I now work for Leicester Square and for the museum, doing still designing things, but programming some comedy, running the competition and doing essentially this. Or just a mixture of things, which is quite good fun, to be honest.
I'll be honest, when I was thinking about what to expect, I mean, I had no idea what sort of thing to imagine would be on display in a museum, and clearly we're in the part of the museum here that is all about comedy still happening. But I was thinking about how you approach curating a comedy museum, because the one thing that isn't there presumably is the joke itself, or the moment of laughter or surprise or whatever it might be. So I imagine there are additional challenges to curating a comedy museum, to curating some other thing that more naturally lends itself to historical items.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think there's a mixture of things, and I suppose one of the reasons we've got performance at Space is because comedy is very current, it's always changing. So if we have people actually in here performing comedy, then that obviously brings that, as you say, that live element, the surprise sort of thing. Although we do have we've got a huge amount of books and comedy records and things, so people can come in here and listen to them. We've got an old record player, so you can play, you know, old LPs on there, or you can listen to VHS tapes, you can watch people performing. So there are several ways you can come in and actually see, quotation marks, that I'm doing the live comedy, whether it's actually live or recorded as live.
I remember about, it's probably longer than I think, 20 years ago, there was that idea that comedy was the new rock and roll. And it seemed to me like that was a long overdue acknowledgement of the live nature of, I guess, the majority of comedy. Sure, we get the stuff on the TV or in films, but there's always been a huge grassroots, whether it's musical or working men's club or comedy club, there's the circuit, there's a lot of live stuff going on. And it's not in the same way as a music gig. These can be very much a one-off thing, can't they? Mm-hmm. One night can be very different to the next, and it doesn't really lend itself perhaps to being memorialised in a museum.
Yeah, I think it is difficult. I think the advantage you've got if you're a musician is that people come see you and they want to hear the old favourites, whereas if you're a comedian, the last thing you want is people sitting there going, heard it, you know, move on, do the next thing. I think comedy is quite difficult because you've always got to be writing something new. You've always got to be coming up with new ideas, otherwise it's... And people memorise jokes, and I think they're very judgmental about things that they've heard before. So, yeah, I think in that regard, it is a very difficult thing to do.
So how... Now, I've seen some of the exhibits. We'll be going and having a look at some of the exhibits in just a sec. One of the first things that struck me was that you're dealing with comedy superstars. Tommy Cooper looms large as you come in. There's bits and pieces from the Carry On films, from Spike Milligan and so forth. Is it difficult to find stuff for your museum from grassroots comics?
No, the main problem we have with space, as you say, it's not the biggest space in the world. I mean, hopefully as time goes on, we'll be able to, you know, take over little other bits of the space that we do have. But that's... It's an ongoing project, but I think we've got a certain core collection. As I said, Martin, who owns, has been working in comedy for 30 years, so a lot of it is stuff that he's collected and stored in his attic and garage, and that was the basis of the whole thing. As soon as we set up, people started coming forward saying we've got this and that and what have you, and like with Spike Milligan, the stuff we've got from him are actually from his daughters who've basically said we'd rather have it here so people can look at it rather than stuck in our garage or whatever out of the way where nobody can do it. So a lot of people are coming forward. Like I said, the main problem is just finding places to put it all. As I said, we've got a huge collection of books. We don't have space for all of them. And a lot of people come... people get in touch and say, do you want this? And we say, yeah, of course we do. And then we just have to, basically we need to take something out to put something in at the moment. But as you know, if you go in, it's like visiting your granny's house or something. There is just stuff everywhere.
This is the classic museum problem, of course, that I don't know, if you're not maybe in the museum world, why would you think of it? But the stuff on display in any museum and in an awful lot of libraries as well, it generally represents a very tiny percentage of what they've actually got and are having to store carefully.
Yeah, yeah, and I think we can only ever represent a small number of the people that were here. So it's useful to have the photographic exhibition so you can at least, you know, have people represented that way. But obviously, I think, like in any collection, there are things missing that we'd like to have. But so if anybody's out there and has anything stored up from any of the greats of British comedy, then, yeah, come and give it to us. That'd be lovely.
We're going to go through now through the doorway here into the museum itself. And it's possibly... well, you mentioned, you've been talking about the lack of space, and I don't know whether I'm about to shame you by mentioning that a previous usage of this place was to store, well, corpses in coffins, and at one point there were 900 of them down here.
Yeah, I'd like to make it clear that I wasn't working here then. It's actually, it's going back quite a few years.
But there are a surprising number of bad jokes that I could make connecting the two.
Feel free. She will be the first or the last. But yeah, I think, and this, we're actually in the performance space now, which was the area that was used apparently for children's coffins. So you could, you know, stack them high, put them in. But it's more like a supermarket than anything else, really.
I've heard, of course, of this chap not far from here, what was it, a couple of hundred years ago, who was essentially chucking people in a pit underneath his house that it sounded as though he was continuing to dig, and there were a lot of bodies down there. But I had no idea that the lack of burial space had produced a situation where the bodies would have to be stored in their coffins but unburied. That's kind of remarkable.
Yeah, weirdly, because I live in Eastland, I was walking... when the tube strike was on, I was walking in and I came, in a route that I wouldn't normally take. And there's actually the church has actually got a burial ground that's about a quarter of a mile, half a mile away from the church, because at the time there was nowhere to put it. There wasn't a, there still isn't a churchyard as such. So there's now a beautiful little park just a little bit east of here.
We're moving into the museum. The good news is that the place made me smile when I walked in. I'm not exactly sure what quality it was, but there was some sort of strange recognition that this is a friendly place.
Yeah, I think it is. It's I think it's a bit strange when you put anything into a space, you're never quite sure how it is. And like with the performer space, for instance, I think if you are a performer, there are some places you go in and you just immediately think, yeah, this is nice. And I think that's very much one of those. It's set up complete for comedy. It's a lovely place to perform. It's a really nice place to watch comedy. But this, yeah, what the museum doubles as the bar area, and it's nice when you have a full crowd and people are milling around before the show, just having a drink, chatting, looking at the exhibition, looking at the things we've got on the wall. It's a really nice atmosphere in here.
What's the place that you would tend to start a tour of the museum at?
Well, exactly where we are now.
Oh, okay.
Chronologically, in the area next to the bars, the sort of music hall section. So this is where we've got some of the older stuff, including a lot of...
I should explain. I was leaning down to look at a picture of a music hall star in her Edwardian finery, and I think David thought I was bowing to the music hall star and gave me a reverential silence in which to do that.
Well deserved. So a lot of this stuff is from the Players Theatre, which is an organisation that's been going for a long, long time. Some listeners might remember The Good Old Days, which was a variety show which ran for years and years and years, which is on TV. I think it was filmed at City Varieties in Leeds, but it started at the Players Theatre in London. And what we're staring at now are some pictures of some of the people who appeared there. And it's probably including Clive Dunn. I think he was Clive Dunn from Dad's Army, who was 17 in this picture, I think.
No way.
Yeah.
Well, the strange thing about this guy is he has always famously played old men.
Yeah.
And so he just has... You just get the impression that he's immortal.
Is he still alive?
I'm not sure. I feel he's not, but I might have to...
Okay. I'm happy to say he is or isn't alive, and definitely on a TV near you at some point.
But in this picture, he already looks as though he's getting ready to play... if that's 17, he looks like he's going to play 40 or 50.
Yeah, he does. He's blessed with that kind of face, isn't he? It's one of the things. And we've also got Hattie Jakes, who's obviously a stalwart of Carry On films and British TV and films for years and years and years. So she was one of the first people to appear there as well.
Really, really interesting, if memory serves, and I hope it does, a really interesting triangle between her and Tony Hancock and John Le Mesurier.
Yes, yeah. She was married to John Le Mesurier and was having a fling with someone. I don't think it was Tony Hancock.
Or was it not Tony Hancock?
I don't think it was. I can't remember who it was. I think it was just some stray young actor. I actually can't remember who it was. That's impressive, isn't it? I can't remember.
Excellent work. That raises a question, though. Are you the sort of person who digs into the biographies and the private lives of comedians, or is it their public face, their work, that you're more interested
in? I'm more interested in the public thing. I think that you pick up bits and pieces about people and read about them. But, for me, it's what they do. It's their performance that makes them interesting. You know, it's... I don't know. You find things out about people and you think, oh, yeah, well, that's obviously had an influence on the way they thought or did things. But it's you know, what lives on about them, I think, if they're real, is the work they're doing on stage.
I'm presuming that you didn't find comedy through a musical, first of all. What was the comedic wave that you surfed in on?
Me? I think, like, when, as a kid, I went to Panto and things like that. And I'm originally from Bradford and... The Alhambra in Bradford has a great pantomime tradition. So growing up, I remember I saw Les Dawson perform there. I saw Charlie Drake. I saw all kinds of people, even like all very old musical stars in the sort of 80s who were still kicking around the circuit doing things would appear in pantomime. I think even as a kid, even watching pantomime, if you see somebody who's properly gifted with comedy, it sort of sticks in your mind. I think that's. Yeah, that's probably my first sort of memory of watching comedians. Then, of course, on TV and stuff, I remember, you know, people like Dave Allen and the Pythons, the usual suspects, really.
I got the impression that there's a bit of a north-south divide of some sort in comedy, and I don't know whether that's fair, but I feel like I see more of the Peter Kay kind of comedy it's a little bit friendlier, frankly, it seems. Maybe just superficially. Is that fair that there's differences in comedy geographically?
Yeah, we're definitely funnier in the north, I think that's... No, I think there's a different attitude. I think I've been in London 20 years now, and I think the main difference, not just in comedy but conversationally, is in the north people seem to be a little bit more self-deprecating and don't really care where the joke comes from in conversational comedy, as long as there's a joke at the end of it. Whether you're the victim of it or not is fine, whereas in southerners... There seems to be more of a thing about having to be the winner. They have to be the person. It's more of a high status. You get high status comedy in the South, whereas in the North it's more of a low status, look at me, I'm an idiot kind of thing. But they're both equally funny. They just come from different angles. And also it's a bit of a generalisation. But I think you're right. I think there is. It's true enough.
Now, does that... Well, that's interesting, though, because does that then make your job... do you have to consider that sort of thing when you're programming... comedy?
No, I put in things that I like, to be honest. I mean, obviously, you don't want... I think when you put in comedy in, you have to be true to what you believe. I've got quite a broad taste in comedy. I don't care whether it's one-liners or physical comedy or clowning or storytelling. I think comedy's either good or it's not good. But it's a very personal thing. So for me, if I go see a show I like and I put it in and hopefully more people will like it, I don't think you can second guess people. I think that's how you end up with things like bland television, by going, this is what the public want, and we need to keep comedy within certain parameters. I'll just if something's funny, it's funny, and not everybody's going to like it. And I think attempting to do things that everybody likes is the road to hell. So don't do it.
let's move around a little bit and see what else is here. Excellent pictures of Tommy Cooper.
Yeah, these are lovely. These are really nice. It's all taken in one sitting by a guy called John Claridge. And we've had this for a while. And it's pictures of Tommy Cooper, who has a very sort of defined persona on TV as a big, jolly man. But these are very stark black and white images where he looks more like one of the Career Brothers in his later years. Yeah, he's a proper East End gangster look about him. In the best way, it's sort of haphazard. So we've got, next to that, we've got a giant autograph picture of Mary Lloyd here, which is nice, one of the sort of original music hall stars.
We were at her graveside a couple of weeks ago up at Hampstead Cemetery.
Really? I've not been there. I've been there. Maybe I have. I've been there. I'm just rambling now.
Well, it's nice to see her in her prime rather than a piece of stone.
Yeah, I think the thing with musicals now, there's a few others. We've got, we'll come round to that. We've got little Titchy Shoes around here. This because we're still in the music hall section. And Little Titch was one of 12 children. Have you heard of him before?
No, I haven't. And what I was expecting as we rounded the corner was not what I saw.
He was from Kent, I think. He's one of 12 kids, grew up in a pub. And his dad, and he was tiny, he was about 4 foot tall, and his dad used to get him perform on the bar, because that's what they did in those days, exploit people. But he became a musical performer, and his trademark was wearing these giant shoes, and there's a poster in the case here, where he's leaning forward towards the top hat, and he used to do this extraordinary dance in the shoes, where he used to stand on the tip of the toes, spin round, do all kinds of things, and the climax of it was he used to bend all the way forward, and just put the hat on without using his hands and stand up again. And if you Google Little Titch, you can find that one remaining bit of film of him doing that. And the nice thing about it is he clearly makes a couple of mistakes in it, but it's still an amazing thing.
I should explain as well that you wouldn't guess that Little Titch were that small from his appearance. He looks like an entirely ordinary person.
Yeah, we need a 50 pence piece in there for perspective.
Why have you got a seagull just here?
this is Russ Abbott's seagull. this seagull has appeared live at the London Palladium with Russ Abbott. And I believe he used it to... I think it was when he was playing... Was it Brook Bond? I can't remember. Yeah, the secret agent. He very suavely struck a light off the cigarette, off the seagull to light a cigarette.
Russ Abbott, I think he gets a bad press sometimes. I think people think he's rather cheesy.
Yeah. But again, he was primetime TV. He was, I mean, I think he was probably one of the biggest stars in the country for several years. And I think people get very judgmental looking back at comedy. There's some comedy that clearly lasts, you know, I think if I watched Laurel and Hardy, they still make me laugh. Hugely. Charlie Chaplin, not so much. But I think it's a lot of comedy, I think, is very much of its time.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And maybe Russ Abbott's one of those. But again, if you look back and watch him, there are still a lot of things about that he does that are just so silly that you can't help but laugh about it, really.
Isn't there a thing as well that we do, and not just restricted to comedy at all, but in this country, I think when somebody gets to a certain level of popularity or fame, then we start to have a grudge against them for that. I don't know whether maybe Michael McIntyre might fall into this sort of bracket because he rocketed to success, and you got the impression that there was just a whiff of a backlash against that rise to popularity.
Yeah, it feels like. Weirdly, I think the people that dislike McIntyre most are comedians. I don't know. I think there's obviously an element of jealousy in there, but I think if you perform comedy, I think McIntyre's brilliant at what he does. It's not particularly to my taste, and I think if you perform comedy, you can sort of see the wheels, you can see the mechanics of what he does, but seeing how something works and actually going out there and doing it yourself are two very different things. But I think you're right. I think once people get hugely successful, and everybody's queuing up to bring them back down. Also, because people are hungry to get there themselves, you know. And it's, I think, a lot of comedy, especially on mainstream television, feels like it's dead men's shoes. And until people are there, they're there forever. And until you can get rid of them, nobody else is, you know, coming in and taking over that spot. So it's a very competitive thing.
I want to know what you're seeing. When you say you can see the wheels turning, what sort of thing are you perceiving there?
Oh, with Michael McIntyre specifically, a friend of mine got some work as a Fat McIntyre tribute act. believe it or not, there's a weird little underground after dinner circuit of people doing impressions of fat impressions of comedians. So there's a Fat McIntyre, and he did it. And I saw him doing little 5 and 10 minute tryouts at various comedy clubs where he was brilliant. He was saying the thing about McIntyre is you see something, you make a noise, and then you do the joke. And you're saying this is the mechanics of the McIntyre joke. Here's a thing, here's a noise to go with that thing, here's my funny thing about that thing, right? And that is essentially how the McIntyre joke works. And in his 5 minutes, when he was remembering to do the impression, he was brilliant. And it was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. And then I saw him a couple of months later after he'd done his first corporate gig, having to do it for half an hour. I said, how did it go? He said, I completely died. It was horrific. He said, for 5 minutes, I was great, and then people just got bored with me. So and knowing how something is and doing it, different things entirely. McIntyre's very, a very skillful comedian. Whether you like him or not, he's very good at what he does.
Have you tried your hand yourself on stage?
Yeah, I perform occasionally.
Uh-huh.
I over several years, I forged a reputation amongst my friends as the laziest comedian on the circuit.
Well, as in not doing any gigs?
Yep.
So the circuit part of that is in dispute by the sounds of it.
Performing comedy is mostly admin, believe it or not. It's, and if you're not very good at admin, you don't get as many gigs as maybe you should. And also not writing any jokes. That was another piece of my armoury.
Let's move on around. In fact, maybe now is an excellent time to remind ourselves of who's paying for all this. Here comes a short commercial message.
We have teamed up with audible.co.uk to offer you a free audiobook of your choice. All you have to do is register for 1 month free trial to claim your free audiobook. There are over 150,000 to choose from. The 30-day free trial means you can choose a free audiobook, which is yours to keep whether or not you decide to cancel in the trial period. And there's more good news. If you trialed the service over 12 months ago, the good people at Audible are giving you a chance to get your hands on another audiobook for free. So sign up at www.audible.co.uk/Londonist.
The Sound of London. Londonist Out Loud with N. Quentin Wolfe. Listen free every week on your favourite podcast platform. Subscribe via iTunes and get great extra content at Londonist.com. Tweet the show at Londonist Sound and see pictures of all our guests on the Londonist Out Loud stream on Instagram.
You're listening to Londonist Out Loud. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe and I am at the Museum of Comedy, and with me David Hardcastle, who is admiring his exhibits. Well, that sounds rude.
Well, they're not. They're Muslim. They're Martin's exhibits. I just help out.
Well, that sounds even worse if I say you're admiring Martin's exhibits.
If you'd met him, you'd know exactly what I mean and how apt that is.
We've got a six-necked guitar, which is instantly recognisable as a Bill Bailey special.
That's right. Which weirdly, we can't find a clip of it online anywhere of him actually using it. So, but it is Bill Bailey's guitar, and he donated it to us. Which is nice. Bill, as I said, we're sort of part of Leicester Square Theatre, so a lot of big names perform in Leicester Square Theatre. So we've had donations from quite a few of them, and this is from Bill, presumably because it's too big to carry about and use.
Oh, so this is a storage facility now.
I'm not sure if he's going to revive the six snick guitar bit, but until then, I think it's with us. Yeah.
Has anyone tried playing it?
No. Or even picking it up, as far as I can tell, it's huge.
We've got Spitting Image puppets further down. I recognise Kenneth Williams.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got Kenneth Williams, Frankie Howard on the other side of the case with his amazing eyebrows. And in other bits of the museum, we've also got Ken Dodd and Tommy Cooper in his own little section.
Now, this suggests to me that you've got relationships with big comedy vehicles.
I think we've got relationships with people who were formerly related with big comedy vehicles. We've got all kinds of relationships with all kinds of different people who variously donate things to us.
I know from a little bit of work around recording studios that trophies are apt to be collected by musical performers and their entourage. Is the same thing going on with comedy?
Yes. I was trying to think of a diplomatic answer then, but there is not. Yes, people forget things and people borrow things and they don't get taken back, do they? I think that's how that works.
Well, a case in point might be the corner couch. Now, this is a banquet. It looks like it's from a pub.
Yes, it is.
Does the pub know about this?
Yeah, Spike Milligan actually. This it's a corner seat. It's a lovely, timeless piece of furniture from the corner of a pub. And I've forgotten the name of the pub, a pub called the Grafton, I believe, in West London. And it's where Spike Milligan actually used to sit and write the Goon Show. So this is the piece of furniture. This is where he used to sit and do it. When the pub was refurbished, he actually bought this piece of furniture himself and had it in his house. After he died, it went to his daughters, and they've got in touch and asked us if we'd like to have it. So that's our. So if you want to come and sit and do some writing, work on your next Edinburgh show or your hit sitcom, you can come and do it in the same seat that Milligan wrote the Goon Show in. And we've also got his record player, weirdly, which is nice. This is this is just an old scratched record player where he used to sit in his house and listen to, presumably while he wrote more shows on these bit of furniture.
So really you ought to be able to just sort of plug yourself in, lower your behind onto the banquette, and
yeah,
genius should flow.
Yeah, hopefully. You can either picture that or you can picture him going, being driven quietly crazy by the ridiculous schedule he had to write the show on. Because he essentially wrote the shows on his own, and they were doing them once a week, and they weren't all written before they started recording them, so he literally used to sit and have a week to write them in. All by himself.
Is that where you get that kind of anarchic vibe? Because they're ad-libbing like crazy.
Possibly. We have actually got some of the original Goon Show scripts here as well, so you can have a look at those. But yeah, I suspect it's relatively speaking an easier ride for the other people in the Goon Show, whereas Spike had to do it and then turn up and also perform the things that he'd just written, and then obviously once the show's recorded, start again on the next one. It's a punishing schedule, I think, to say the least.
Out of the corner of my eye, as we've been talking, two costumes have been finding their way into my peripheral vision. One of them, it looks like a patchwork greatcoat, and the other one, now, I haven't read the label, and I can't from this distance, this has got to be something to do with Danny LaRue.
Yep, that's Danny LaRue's costume, or one of Danny LaRue's costume, which is exactly what you'd expect.
Yes, white ostrich feathers, lots of bling, gold high heel boots.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think it's the bling sort of hits your eye first. The other thing you notice is it's massive. I think he was quite a big man, Danny LaRue, and it is. I'm so tempted to slip into it, but I'm not sure about, or if it would work on a podcast.
Was he as popular as some of the other acts that we've been describing?
I read somewhere that for a couple of years, Danny LaRue was the highest paid entertainer in the country. He was mainstream TV, worked a lot in clubs, did his own sort of review shows, was absolutely massive, yeah. I think, again, you look back, we were talking about McIntyre earlier and how big he is, but if you look back at some of them, the Victorian ones, some of the music hall stars, There are people there that were at the top of the game for 20, 30 years, earning the sort of money, relatively speaking, the same sort of money that the big stars earn now, but with much longer careers because they weren't on TV, they tore the theatres and what have you, and then ridiculous amounts of money. And I suppose Danny LaRue was probably at the back end of that kind of thing, where there weren't so many TV channels, so if you were a star on TV then, you were a star everywhere, you know, everybody knew you, and he was huge.
And the downside of that is almost too obvious to say, but the downside of being seen by everybody is that your material's been heard in that one sitting by everybody all at once.
Yeah, I guess so. Although, yeah, obviously at that stage you get people writing for you as well, but I suppose he was singing songs as well, which is obviously cheating in comedy, so you don't need as many jokes to fill the time with that, but yeah.
Where should we go next?
Wherever you like. What should we do?
No, I'm following you. That has got to be the best answer I've ever had on a where should we go next question.
let's keep it slick. Let's go to the Russ Abbott case.
Well, there really is an entire case dedicated to the guy.
Yeah, I mean, this is, like I said, when Martin first started working, he was doing a lot on literally end of the pier shows in Blackpool, and one of the people he worked a lot with was Russ Abbott. So there's quite a lot of memorabilia from him here. There's a couple of his scout uniform, I forgot the name of the character, his teddy boy uniform, and just lots of bits and pieces. A picture of the seagull at the London Palladium is in there.
Is he still performing?
I've no idea. I think he's still.
He's doing some serious work, wasn't he?
Was he in Last of the Summer Wine?
Oh, really?
I think so. Huh. I don't watch it, but I think he was.
Now, that is a fine example of something that's in light of what we were saying about scripts and material,
yeah,
and using it all up, it seems to me that has just been a constant for, I don't know what it is, 30 years or something, 35 years? I have no idea. But they haven't seemed to vary the jokes one iota, just the same product every week.
Yeah, that's definitely a show with a formula, wasn't it? They would have, something would happen, but then something else would happen, then Compo would go down the street in a bath, and that was, as far as I could tell.
If it works.
That's how it works. Yeah, exactly. It works. And I did actually weird another interesting fact, that years ago, because it's got a laugh track on it, they used to get a laugh track by screening it at the Photography Museum in Bradford, so the laugh track would sound northern.
That's interesting. I've often wondered how the is that the usual way to get the laugh track? Because I always wonder whether they just have people laughing at whatever it might be and then just sellotape it on.
Yeah, I am sometimes wondering what people are laughing at with these certain things. But yeah, I guess so. I thought working TV, but I think that's a standard way of doing things. It must be.
There's nothing eerier, is there, than watching a TV show where the laughter obviously doesn't belong to what's going on?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I quite like watching comedy in bemused silence for the most part.
Any tips on that? Just on that score, is there anything you can do if you've got a performer on live who is, for whatever reason, failing to ignite the crowd?
Yeah.
Is there anything you can do to help them along?
No, I just sit back and enjoy it. I think, especially as anybody who performs comedy knows that at some point you all die. Everybody has a bad gig, and you just have to embrace it. I think once you've been doing it long enough, if you've been doing it a while and you know that your material's okay and you've done well before, you know it's not the joke's fault and it's probably not the audience's fault. It's just one of those things. So you just like, leave it, forget it. The only thing you can do is it's up to whoever's on after. So if it's an MC on after them, then they just have to pick it up a bit and get the audience going again and move it along. I think acknowledge it is the best thing. You have to get, if you stood there going, no, I'm brilliant and it's all your fault and you're not going to get anywhere. If you go, yeah, sorry guys, it's not working, then I think it puts everybody at ease a little bit.
Is it possible to pull it back from that point?
It is. Yeah, I booked Paul Foot to do a show in Edinburgh as a closing act, and there was no show after us, so that was fine. So he did his 20 minutes to close to silence, complete silence. They hated him. And he then did another 20 minutes explaining why they weren't laughing at his first 20 minutes and completely took the roof off. It was amazing. But then that's Paul Foot. He's very good. not everybody can do that. The worst thing is watching some brand new act performing to silence for 3 or 4 minutes and then thinking they can do another 10 minutes and make everybody love them. They can't. Get off.
That is the official line.
Yeah, yeah. Really?
Because that's one of my biggest anxieties, and I mean this as an audience member, and it makes me sometimes too anxious to go and see something live rather than watching it on a screen, is knowing that things are supposed to be coming off in a different way and feeling that disconnect and feeling the stage seem ever further away.
Well, yeah, but I think, again, that's one of the exciting things about live comedy. You know, it's not sanitised, it's not removed, it is, you are very much there in the moment, and it can, I mean... Most audiences are very good. They want you to succeed. You know, you don't really get audiences that are baying for blood so much. So you've got that going for you. But as I said, comedy is so subjective, and especially if people are doing something that's slightly left field, that's not, you know, just straight up telling jokes. It can definitely... Again, Paul Foot, I watched for years doing nothing, and then suddenly he found a way to connect with the audience without necessarily changing what he was doing, but just found a way in the first couple of minutes going, yeah, come with me, come on board with this. And since then, I've rarely seen him have a bad gig, I think. I think a lot of it's just down to experience and, you know, learning your craft, really. I think that's sort of underestimating in comedy, especially now when people get thrown onto TV. I think, sometimes before they're ready. I think it used to be that you had to serve an apprenticeship of 10 or 15, 20 years. So with whatever you think of the comedians back in the 70s, you rarely saw somebody that wasn't middle-aged and experienced, you know, in the art of what they were doing.
Mm.
Whereas now, I think sometimes you see people that are clearly out of the depth who are... Anyway, you know what I mean.
A glance at the watch shows, we're coming up to the end of the show already. So probably a good moment to ask about what's going on in London as far as comedy goes, which is maybe too big a question, I don't know.
Well, clearly the places to go are, well, here at the museum, as in a lot of places, we've got, we're currently in a season of post-Edinburgh festival shows. So most nights in September, and I think every night in October, we've got two shows from of people who've been performed in Edinburgh, and they're coming down and doing it here.
Now, what does that mean in practical terms? Does that mean they've been supercharged and road tested, and they're coming down here, and this is good hot material?
Yes, exactly. So they've all been performing the shows for a month in Edinburgh. They're all polished, slick, learnt, which is always a bonus, and they're coming down. And pretty much this is generally speaking your last chance to see them doing those shows. And certainly if you look on our website, there's a list of very, very good shows that run here, and also at our other theatre, at Leicester Square Theatre downstairs in the lounge. There's a lot of Edinburgh shows on there as well.
Who would you circle in your diary?
As I've put most of them in, I can't really choose to. Although one,
it's a totally unfair question.
It's very unfair.
Out of the performers that you've booked, which is the best?
I don't know if any of them are listening and have got any spare cash. This is the time to fish it out of your wallet. The next one, I think, this week we've got who's worth seeing is Tim Shishodia. I said earlier we run a new comedian competition at Leicester Square. Rob Beckett was our first winner of that. I think Tim won the second one. And we were talking about the comedy industry, and we've recently set up, this summer we ran a competition here called Old Comedian, which is not old in terms of years, you only have to be 35, but it's for comedians that have been going at least 5 years, who've been sort of bypassed by the industry. And Tim, after triumphantly winning New Comedian several years ago, entered and won Old Comedian in the summer. And I saw his show in Edinburgh, and it's lovely. It's just a lot of very silly jokes and a lot of good fun, and well worth seeing. So if you're around on Friday, I don't know when this goes out, but if you're around on Friday...
It goes out on Saturday.
You've missed him. He was brilliant. But there's a lot. I mean, just check it out on the website. There's a lot of... Well, I think what was nice for me in Edinburgh this year is there's a lot of very silly things going on. People who are just doing an hour of being funny, which is... There's a strange thing about the Edinburgh Festival where a lot... You know, there's this convention that it has to have a through line, a story, beginning, middle, end. There has to be progress. There has to be a lesson learned at the end of it, which is fine. But it's really nice to see people just being funny for an hour and disregarding all that convention. And there's a lot of that this year, and I've booked quite a few of them in. So if you want an hour of silly, I think this is a good place to come.
What better way to finish off? That was the act you could have seen.
And we'll see again.
And we'll see again. And a reminder of the website.
It's just museumofcomedy.com or leicestersquaretheatre.com. They're linked.
And David Hercastle, thanks very much indeed.
A pleasure. Thank you very much. My heart aches for some far
off days, no one could have left you. And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to David Hardcastle. Thanks to Mark Barrett and Bernie Barclay. 3 minutes of level music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm then Quentin Wolfe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.